Hello, good morning, everyone. Please find a seat. We're about to start the next session. I'm your host and chair, Dan Milisavljevic. This is session number 5 on supernova ejecta and dust. And it's my pleasure to first introduce Brian Williams. He'll be speaking to us about what we can learn from ejecta and supernova remnants. Please.
Okay, I think now I'm on, right? So thank you, Dan, and thank you, everyone, for being here for the first talk of the morning. I was asked to cover ejecta and supernova remnants, and I have to give a few disclaimers first. Oh, there we go. Good. A few disclaimers first. This is a review talk of a very broad topic. I would love to, but I can't cover everything. I can't cite everyone. I've made an attempt to sort of cover a lot of recent progress in this field. A few topics I won't be covering, only because they're covered in later talks, are dust and supernova remnants, pulsar wind nebulae. Those are two other review talks as part of this morning's session. If I do cover your work, but I misrepresent it, I apologize in advance. Please feel free to correct me afterwards. You can yell at me during the question and answer session if you want. But I have made an attempt to at least misrepresent everyone equally. So. This is a situation that I think everyone in this room has found themselves in. You meet somebody who's non-astronomer, they say, what do? You tell them, you say, what you work on, and say, what's a supernova remnant? And I usually start by saying, well, it's an explosion in space, and then a shockwave moves out and sort of heats up the gas and dust in space. And that's what this is showing. This is the forward shock. But of course, that's not the whole picture. So if someone's really interested, then I go on and say, and we also see a lot of the stuff that was once part of the star that, you know, is also expanding outward, and that's what we call the ejecta. So that's what this talk is going to focus on. I'll start off by showing a remnant that actually, I don't think most people know what this remnant is. This is called Cassiopeia A. We haven't yet seen anything in this talk about this, but this is just a simple X-ray image, and just a little bit of background here that one of the cool things about X-ray astronomy is that, you know, every modern X-ray telescope is essentially an integral field unit, so we get spectral information along with the imaging information. And we can do things like break it up into various energy bands, and we can show how, you know, various species are distributed throughout the remnant. So that was an X-ray image. A few years ago, Delaney et al. Did this in the infrared as well. They actually created a spectral map from infrared data. And they showed that, you know, given how the velocities are distributed, what's the structure of the remnant like in 3D? Milisavljevic and Fiesen came along a few years later and added in some of the optical data to this. And I'm actually going to show a movie here. I don't think this movie's been shown yet at this conference. But it's about a minute-long movie, and it's gonna go through various things. And I was thinking, you know, I could narrate this talk, or narrate this movie, but I'm one of only two people on stage that has a microphone, and of the two of us, I'm the least qualified to do this. So I'm going to yield 1 minute of my time to our session chair. Who's going to describe this?
I'm going to yield it to Rob, actually. No, okay, so it's rotating around. This is optical ejecta that's been shocked, reverse shocked, and the thing to take away from this is that it's not random. There's large-scale structure inherent to it. Ejecta rings, that's been brought up a lot. Now, where's the origin of rings? We associate with internal cavities. Now, this is rotating about. We can have another view about it. You can see that there's a large ejecta ring that's rolling around the back at the moment. That's the dominant lobe. Okay, now we're introducing an internal sphere to kind of help to see what's in the front and what's in the back. And it's a very gross approximation of the location of the reverse shock, but we know that that's complicated. We're going to twirl around again. There, that the large ring just passed by. You can see smaller rings. There's at least 6 rings that we saw in the Mercator projector. Now we're going to zoom back. We're going to see the higher velocity ejecta. I'll try not to say jets. Coming towards us right now is the northeast region, and then the opposing jet. And now we're doing, so now you can see where HST image with respect to it, and it's been color-coded by velocity. So blue is blue shifted, red is red shifted in the back.
Very well done. Thank you. I will now take back the remainder of my time. getting along with CASSE, one of the cool results that came out a few years ago was a new star image CASSE, and in addition to finding the hard continuum, it also found the radioactive titanium in the remnant. Titanium is interesting because you don't need to have it reverse shock to see it. So, you know, most ejecta and supernova remnants needs to pass through the reverse shock to be hot enough to emit. In titanium, you're not seeing it because it's hot. You're seeing it because it's radioactive. What was interesting about this was NuSTAR kind of found it in the wrong place, because a lot of models predicted that titanium and iron are synthesized in the same place, but when you looked at it, it may be a little bit hard to tell from this, but the iron K alpha is in red and the titanium is in blue, and the red and the blue stuff doesn't quite overlap. So this was a little bit of a surprise. You can see these papers here. I've indicated for more on this. But moving on to Tycho, this is a paper that came out a few years ago from Sato and Hughes, where they looked at some of the small knots in Tycho, and they've sort of indicated these here. They have about eight knots or so that they looked at. And they found that a lot of them were significantly blue shifted and a lot of them were significantly red shifted. So even knots that are right next to each other in projection, one of them might be screaming that way at 4,000 kilometers per second, and the other one might be coming towards us. So the mean of these velocities was something like 5,000 for the red shifted and 3,000 for the blue shifted. This is a movie. I think I showed this movie when I gave this talk 3 years ago, but it never hurts to show it again. This is 15 years of expansion of Tycho from Chandra. So there's something like, I think there's five epochs that are included in this. And you can see, you know, especially with the background stars, what it looks like. But you can see that not only is the forward shock expanding, but the eject is expanding as well. So I had a paper a few years ago where we looked further into this, and we said, well, we can actually measure the eject velocities in 3D, not just the line of sight stuff, but you can combine the line of sight velocity with the proper motions, and you can actually get a 3D velocity vector map of this object. So we did this. We identified something like 60 regions within the remnant that were bright enough to get a good spectrum of, that were, you know, isolated enough that we felt like we were just getting one knot, and that had a significant enough proper motion that we could measure it over the video that I just showed you there. So we did this. I don't have as fancy a ways as what we saw in the previous movie of showing how to visualize this, but I did find some software online that lets you sort of 3D plot vectors. And I wish I had, if I had my computer, I could actually spin you around in 3D in real time and we could look at this. But we plotted all 60 of these velocity vectors and did sort of averaging and looking at various ways to see is there a preferential velocity this way or this way or this way. We didn't find any of that. I'll just show you a few different angles here. The velocities did range, and these are the 3D velocities. This is scaled to like 3 kiloparsecs. So if you have a favorite distance for Tycho, you can scale it however you like. The velocities range from 2,400 to 6,500, but the mean value is about 4,500 kilometers per second. It sort of looks like it's a flattened ellipse. That's an optical illusion because we didn't have anything right down the center of the remnant, because you can't get proper motions if it's not moving that way. But we didn't see any sort of preferential velocity for the eject in the remnant. And we made a tentative conclusion that has a lot of caveats to it, and I can go through all those. But when you compare this with the explosion models, and these are explosion models that I think we'll hear more about later in this session, some explosion models are more symmetric, some explosion models are less symmetric. So we at least tentatively said that at least the silicon ejecta, which is the only one thing we were looking at, we weren't looking at the iron, and I'll actually talk about the iron in a minute, at least the silicon ejecta looks like it's fairly symmetric. So we did one other thing, though, and that's that when you look at Tycho, you see all this sort of fluffy structure, and these things are clearly contained in knots. And there's at least two reasons that might happen. Is it that the ejecta was smooth initially, but then Rayleigh-Taylor instabilities caused the knots to form? Or is it that the structure was clumpy initially? These are actually two hydrodynamic simulations. These are 2D slices of a 3D simulation that we did, where we just took each of these starting, you know, this one starts with smooth ejecta, and the Rayleigh-Taylor instabilities cause these. These start with clumpy ejecta, and that's what it evolves to. Obviously, these look very different, but we wanted to see if the kinematics could tell us anything. So I actually did the same thing that I did with the real image on this image. I just took two epochs at different times and measured them, and we have, because these are simulations, we know exactly what it is. And we found that we couldn't, based on the kinematics, say anything about which of these was correct, because they both roughly agreed with what Tycho really looked like. So I sort of gave up on that. I said, well, there's nothing we can do. However, thankfully, and I think we can all agree this, thankfully progress in astronomy is not limited to only my cleverness. More clever people come along after me and said, I think there is something we could do. This is a slide that's courtesy of Toshiki Sato, who is a postdoc who's working with me at Goddard. And he said, well, I think we can look at the morphology of this and actually do some real statistics on that. So he has a method that he's developed with his colleagues in Japan that's sort of similar to what people do in the cosmic microwave background, where you're looking at the power spectrum of what's where the structures are. He calls this genus statistics. He looks at, you know, what the structure of them are in terms of how many, what he calls clumps and holes, which is just a knot or not a knot of emission. And what he finds, and this is a paper that was just accepted in the past 2 weeks or so it's on AstroPH. What he finds is that the genus statistics do clearly favor one model over the other. The clumpy model, which is the blue and the green are what Tycho actually looks like. It's both the intermediate mass elements and the iron. That's from the real data. The red curves are the best fit genus statistics to that, and you can see we clearly favor one of those two over the other. Now, again, there are all sorts of caveats on this. I'm not claiming that this is definitely now how type 1a supernovae work. We've done this for one object and two simulations of one object. So this is just a proof of principle of things that I think we can do in the future. Moving on, ejecta asymmetries. I know we're going to have a talk, at least one talk about this on Thursday, so I won't go too deep into this, but Holland, Ashford et al. Had this paper from a few years ago where they looked at the overall ejecta asymmetry, just the morphological asymmetry, and compared that with the neutron star kicks. So obviously these are all core collapse supernovae if we have a neutron star. And they found that in most cases, the direction that the ejecta is going and the direction that the neutron star is going are opposite to each other. There was one weird case, RCW 103. I'll talk more about that in a second, but again, there's going to be a talk on this on either Thursday or Friday. Katsuda et al. Did sort of the same thing. They went a little bit further. They separated the X-ray emission into ejecta and ISM components. They mostly agree with the results from what I just showed, with one exception, which is this RCW 103. They actually find the opposite result. They find that the ejecta is going one way, the neutron star is going the other. So, yeah, there we go. What about in type 1a supernovae, though? Are there ejecta asymmetries there? I showed some results from Tycho earlier where I said we didn't see a lot of evidence for ejecta asymmetries. But this is a paper by Kasuga et al., 2018, where they looked at Kepler, and they actually find that there are asymmetric expansion of the iron ejecta. So I think the question is still very much open about how are the ejecta actually distributed? Are they symmetric? Are they not symmetric? But going back to Tycho, because I said I was going to come back to this, this is an equivalent width image, which is just sort of a measure of how strong the line emission is in a given line. This is the silicon. It actually looks pretty evenly distributed. There's maybe a little bit more in the south, but I really had to go into DS9 and stretch this to show the difference. The south is maybe 5% brighter than the northern half of this object. But if you do the same thing for the iron, it's not quite the same. You can see the iron is not perfectly evenly distributed. You have a little bit of a ring structure up here, where it's probably some of locating the reverse shock. But you see there's also this really bright knot of emission down here that's almost blowing out of the remnant that's super iron rich. So more on that little knot down there to the bottom left. This is a paper by Michelli et al. They looked at various regions of Tycho, and they report detection of other iron group elements, not just iron. Iron K-alpha is easy to find. It's really bright. But there are fainter species like chromium and manganese and nickel that you can look for that are all sort of around iron in the spectrum. They're all around 6 keV. So they looked at this iron knot, and they looked at other parts of Tycho, and they said there is faint emission there. Yamaguchi et al., though, came along 2 years later, looked more in detail at that knot itself, that little knot down there, and said that they didn't find any evidence for chromium, manganese, iron. This is the spectrum that they show. Clearly, the bright iron K-alpha line is there. But these spaces where you might expect to see chromium and manganese, the red is just a simulated spectrum showing that it's not present in the data of that small knot. So that's sort of interesting because in another paper, in another remnant, we looked at 3C397, and we saw very strong chromium, manganese, nickel features. You definitely can't say those aren't there. And this paper, what we claimed was that because you see strong features of these iron group elements, what we know about nuclear burning and white dwarfs, We think that can only be made in super dense cores of a white dwarf. And to get a core that dense corresponds to a Chandrasekhar mass, or very near Chandrasekhar mass white dwarf. So we said that this was perhaps indicative of a single degenerate progenitor for this object, for 3C397. So I just want to recap what I just said over the past couple slides, because if you missed it, something interesting is happening here. We have two what we very much believe to be type 1A objects. In one of them, we see a whole lot of iron, but we see almost no iron group elements other than iron. It's a little hard to see the red here. But I said on the left, I said that favors a sub-Chandrasekhar mass white dwarf. So perhaps that's evidence of some sort of double degenerate explosion. In another type 1A, we also see a lot of iron, but we also see a lot of other iron group elements. And what I have in red here that you can't read is that favors a Chandrasekhar mass white dwarf. So do we have two bright local XNRs in our galaxy that show evidence for very different nuclear burning regimes, maybe different explosion types? Is this evidence for more than one channel for 1A supernovae? I leave that as a question to the audience. I think there's a lot of caveats you could poke in this. There's a lot of holes you could poke in this. You don't have to. I have a microphone. I'll do it for you. There's a lot of things. Maybe we don't understand nuclear burning as well as we think we do. Maybe 3C397 isn't even a 1A. Maybe it's some weird core collapse that made a lot of iron. Again, you can make a whole list of these things that where this might be wrong, but I do think it's interesting that not all type 1A remnants look alike. Clearly in the amount of stuff that's produced in the explosion, it's not all the same. I don't know why that is. Another object that I think is interesting is W49B. There was a paper several years ago by Laura Lopez who looked at the ejecta abundances in W49B and said these are most consistent with a jet-driven core collapse explosion, basically a type 1BC, correct me if I'm wrong, but that made a gamma, was it a gamma ray burst? Laura's here somewhere. I think that's right. Yeah, she's nodding, that's right. I thought that's interesting. Then another paper came out last year where they did sort of a similar abundance of W49B and said that the ejecta abundances are actually most consistent with a type 1A supernova. And I thought this was interesting because these two approaches took basically the same approach. They just looked at the ejecta abundances, looked at the various models for core collapse supernovae type 1A, came to very different conclusions. I don't have a dog in this fight. I just want to point out that there are at least two explanations for one object here. So I believe there's a poster out there on this from Zhu and Vink. So anyway, you can talk with them about that. I just try to start fights. I don't try to finish the fights. Let me move on. I don't know how many people were here 3 years ago at this conference, but you might recall that 3 years ago, I stood up here, I gave a talk, and I showed basically publicly for the first time that spectrum on the left. That spectrum on the left is the spectrum of the Perseus cluster. There is a reason I'm showing a cluster spectrum. It's a story that's all going to come together in a second. This was from Hitomi, the Astro-H satellite that was launched in February of 2016, was lost about a month into the mission. We had this conference in June of 2016, and we actually had some real data. So I showed that. I showed on the right, that's just zooming in on the Iron K alpha line of what it looks like. The blue line that you see is the best previous spectrum of that iron line. That's the Suzaku spectrum. So that's what Hitomi gave us over Suzaku. There was some remnant science, though, that we got out of this. The mission only lasted for about a month, but there were several interesting remnant papers that came out of this. One of those was N132D. This is a core collapse remnant in the Large Magellanic Cloud. It's a very bright X-ray source, so it was one of our early targets because we're just sort of doing commissioning and trying to get attitude control down. You can sort of see from this figure on the top right, we didn't yet have our attitude control working. This was not related to the ultimate mishap. This was just something we hadn't yet gotten the pointing stable. So the object was actually drifting out of the field of view as we were collecting data on this. But we got enough data. So the spectrum is a very short, I actually don't remember, but it's maybe only a few kiloseconds of data. And it doesn't look like much, but if you actually zoom in on the iron K line and on the sulfur line, which is also very bright here, you actually have a few counts in those lines. And there's something like, You can actually count it up if you want to. You can say, you know, I have the count numbers on the left, and there's something like 15 to 17 counts in each one of these lines from this very short exposure from Astro H. It turns out, though, that's still enough. That is enough counts when you have high spectral resolution to do some science with. We actually published a paper on this. We published a paper that said that if you model these line complexes, it turns out that the iron K line is shifted by something like 800 kilometers per second with respect to the sulfur line. So you can check out this paper that we wrote. There's several of us here that were involved in this. We can talk more about that. The error bars on this are really large, as you would imagine. We had intended to go much deeper on this. But this, if this is correct, if it really is correct that the sulfur emission has virtually no overall bulk velocity with respect to the all the other ejecta, but that the iron emission is shifted by 800 kilometers per second, this almost certainly has implications for the explosion models of core collapse supernovae. So I hope we can, we certainly will be going back to that object. But I said I showed the Perseus cluster spectrum for a reason. Turns out there's actual supernova remnant science here that you can get out of the Perseus cluster. Most of what you're seeing in the X-ray spectrum of the cluster is the intracluster, you know, the hot gas that's sort of in between the galaxies. Well, the intracluster medium is just a result of billions of years of billions of supernovae exploding and enriching the cluster medium. And if you actually look at these iron group elements, these faint elements like chromium and manganese, ones that are really faint and really hard to get with CCD instruments, but you have a high spectral resolution instrument, you can pick these things out. And if you look at the abundances contained there and you say, are these consistent with sub-Chandrasekhar mass explosions or Chandrasekhar mass explosions, it turns out the result is right in between the two. Now, again, error bars are substantial on this, but we have a paper that claims that the overall mix, or the overall amount of these iron group elements is consistent with some amount of both, roughly 50% of each of those two explosion models contributing to the intercluster medium. So we have other SNR papers that we got out of Hitomi. I don't have time to cover these. Several of them are on the CRAB. The CRAB happens to be a really bright source, so you don't need much data on that to get something useful out of it. We have a paper of G21.5. So anyway, these are all online. You can check all of these out. I took this slide from the talk I gave 3 years ago. I only made one edit. The only edit I made, as I said, we have something like 13 scientific papers that we got out of the Hitomi data, even though it only lasted for a few weeks. But I think that what I've just showed is that this is clearly a transformational leap forward. I think clearly being able to do high-resolution spectroscopy is the future of X-ray astronomy. With that, allow me to introduce you to the recovery mission, which we've now renamed. It was called CHARM. It is now called CRISM. That's how you pronounce it, by the way, since people have asked. The X-ray Imaging and Spectroscopy Mission. This is basically a rebuild of the Astro H satellite. My day job, I get paid to do this, so that's why I'm actually obligated to talk to you about this object, or this mission. But the executive summary of this is that this is, again, it's recovering the science that was lost with the loss of the Astro H mission. We have two instruments. Our workhorse instrument is called Resolve. It's a soft X-ray spectrometer. It is not a high-resolution imager by any means. We have 30 arc second pixels, but we have very good non-dispersive spectroscopy that we can use for extended sources. Because again, gratings on Chandra and XMM are good for point sources, not so great for extended sources. But with non-dispersive spectroscopy, we can do things with supernova remnants, clusters, all sorts of stuff. This is just showing Hitomi on the left, CRISM on the bottom right. Now this is sort of like in the magazines when you were a kid. There's a difference between these two images. And the difference is that CRISM is more of a yellowish color, and this one's more of a transparent see-through color. There is one other image, though. The reason I show this image is that we do not have the extendable beam on the end. We had to take that off, which means we don't have hard X-ray capabilities on CRISM. We were going to have those on Astro H. We had to give up on that to get this mission launched. I showed it on the previous slide, I think, but we have a tentative launch date of somewhere around February 2022. So that's less than 3 years from now. I don't know if the plans are to have this conference again in 3 years. I hope we do. This is one vote for having it again in June of 2022. And I am certainly not promising anything, but if we launch on time and if we have another conference, then maybe we could have some early results from CRISM there. So I hope that's the case. this is just a chart that shows what we expect to get out of the mission. The energy resolution on Hitomi that we got was something like 5 EV. Again, for Chandra, it's something like 150 or something like that EV. So significant improvement there. I won't go through all of these, but you can sort of read them on your own. The one that I do want to point out is the cryogen lifetime. CRISM has to be cryogenically cooled. You have to get down to 50 millikelvin in order to detect X-ray photons and the temperature change from X-ray photons that come in. We have enough cryogen to last us 3 years. Our early projections from Hitomi were that they would have lasted something like 4 years. The reason I point this out, though, is because I want to clear up a misconception that when the cryogen runs out on CRISM, that's not the end of the mission. We actually will still get the same performance after the cryogen runs out. The only thing it costs us is operational efficiency, because we have to mechanically cool down to 50 millikelvin rather than liquid helium and ADRs and things that, like that, that cool it down. So we have every reason to believe that this mission can last significantly longer than 3 years with the same capabilities. So what will CRISM look like for a supernova remnant? This is the Chandra spectrum of Kepler. That's actual real data because it's such a deep observation, you can barely see the error bars. But if you look out here on the end, you can sort of see the error bars. But that's real data. And that is a real simulation. So that's the exact same model that I had for Kepler, and I just passed it through the CRISM response. So let me do that again for effect. We will go from that to that. Now, of course, we won't have the spatial resolution, but Chandra has already provided the spatial resolution. So I hope people can already imagine the level of science that you can do with this. I don't think I need to spell it out. But the important thing is that I hope people are thinking about this, because after a commissioning phase and a performance verification phase, the duration of the mission is going to be a geo phase, open to the entire community. Just as Chandra, XMM, Suzaku were, will have once yearly calls for proposals, and it will be driven by the community, not by us, after the first 6 months or so. So I hope you're already thinking of your ideas. I hope you're thinking of what you could do with a spectrum like that. Let me end a totally different note just before my last slide, that if you are a postdoc, or if you want to be a postdoc, if you want to come to Goddard, it turns out we have a hire open right now for someone doing supernova, supernova remnant science at Goddard. There's 2 years of funding already. Non-US citizens are okay. I hate to say this, for certain political reasons, there are certain countries we can't necessarily hire, but for the most part, non-US citizens are okay for this. We're flexible on the start date. The only downside of this is the person you'd be working for is me. But I do have funding for this, so if you're interested in this job, please come talk to me. The job ad is out on the job register now. End with some final thoughts. I have no idea how to conclude a talk like this, where I've just been all over the map. But I do want to say thank you to the organizers, giving me the privilege of covering all the work that people are doing. Also a significant workload to cover all the work that people are doing. I apologize again if I couldn't get to everyone's work. I can only scratch the surface of this, but if I didn't talk about what you did and you want me to in the next SNR conference that we have here, please come and tell me about your work, and I'd be happy to look at your poster. So I'll end there. Thank you.
Wonderful. Okay, we're going to open it up for questions now. Okay, and as people think about that, chew on it, I have a placement. Could you show that image of 3C397? Whenever I see this, I try to ask, and I never get a straight answer out of it.
I got to get back a few.
Yeah, sure, that one there.
This one, yep.
It kind of looks like a puzzle. Right. And I mean that both literally and metaphorically. It has very odd morphology about it. Could you comment something about it? And maybe it plays into one of the progenitor scenarios?
I don't know the answer. I agree it sort of looks like a rectangle. It looks like a milk bottle turned on its side, sort of.
Mm-hmm. It's a Rorschach test. You'll see what you want.
Yeah, exactly.
But it's odd, right?
Yep. Whatever you most fear shows up in that image, I think. I don't know about what that is. My guess is that it has something to do with the interstellar or the CSM structure around the remnant. But I don't know more about that. I was on this paper, but this is not a remnant that I've studied a lot. But yeah, I think it is a very odd shape. But again, my guess is that it just has something to do with the interstellar medium around the object.
Right. Well, my question being is that does it favor one progenitor scenario and another? And just naively, if you want to go with the single degenerate progenitor scenario, perhaps its companion somehow helped shape the environment around it prior to explosion.
Yeah, it's a good question. I don't know. I mean, I think that's a question for the people who do hydro simulations and take these explosion models and run them out. The conclusion that we came to here about the Chandrasekhar mass white dwarf was made solely based on the ejecta abundances of the chromium and manganese and nickel lines. So I agree with your question. I have sort of the same question. I just don't have a great answer to it. But it is a very odd shape. I don't know that, if you were to say, well, it's a core collapse supernova, not a 1A, I would still have the same question. Why does it look like a rectangle? So I don't know.
Sure. Fair enough. I see hands up now, so Jeremiah there.
Nice talk. Thanks for that summary. Can you go to your slide where you're comparing the two 1A supernova remnants and you come to two different conclusions?
That's
there
right.
We go.
Yep.
Has anyone done the inference on this statement? In other words, The thing that you're really getting to is the density of the white dwarf before it exploded, which is tying it to the YE. Is there an inference on that number, like either the density of the YE and an error bar?
There is. I don't know it off the top of my head, but I know at least for the 3C397 paper, we have some numbers in there about the central density. I don't remember off the top of my head.
Okay.
But yeah,
I'll
there's a nice
plot
out in there that shows. And then it shows it actually for various metallicities of the white dwarf.
Yeah, okay.
So, yeah.
The other question I had is, there was one that was associated with core collapse, and you said that the sulfur and the iron have different velocities.
Yep.
The iron if I remember right, it was like 800 kilometers per second?
Yep.
Yeah. Is that coming towards us or away from us with respect to the sulfur?
Do I say that here? Was it redshift? Oh, okay, yeah. Highly redshifted X-ray emission. There you go. It's redshifted.
Yeah, but which one? The sulfur or the iron?
The iron.
The iron, okay.
Yeah, the iron is redshifted.
Okay.
Very good. In the back there, yeah. Gloria. In the middle back there.
Dan Patnott already has a microphone. Can we
okay,
do first?
But we'll be sure to get back. Yes, go ahead.
So back to the Tycho and 3C397
yep.
result. I'm wondering if you can comment. So for Tycho, Carlos claimed it was a normal 1A based on the composition, but he wouldn't ever speculate on whether his models are from a double degenerate or a single degenerate scenario, although I think that Bravo might say that they're single degenerate models. So is based on what he wrote in 2005-ish versus what he also wrote in 2015. Does he have any? Do you guys have anything new to say about Tycho being double degenerate versus single degenerate? Is his result from 2005 still valid, or is he now calling into question those models?
I don't have any reason to believe it's invalid now. Yeah. As far as new results, I don't. Is Armin here? Don't we have a light echo of this? I think it's a normal 1A. Is it a normal? Yeah, the light echo looks like a normal 1A, so that's certainly new since 2005. We definitely don't have a light echo for this one, at least that I know of, but that would be an interesting one to find if possible. Now, this is an older object. It's probably much more difficult to find a light echo of it, but if we could find one, it would be very interesting to see if that looks like a normal 1A or a superluminous, subluminous. I don't know what it would look like. So.
Yes, please.
It's a comment about the shape of 3C397. Years ago, we published a paper with Safi Arb studying the interstellar medium, and there are no molecular clouds that can justify the shape. So we carried out a complete study of the interstellar medium, and it's not responsible for the shape.
All right, well, so there you go.
Safi Arb et al. the paper.
Then do you know why it's shaped like that? Because I don't.
Okay. That's part of the solution, yes. Any other questions?
Well, this is about W49B. Apart from the question whether it's core collapse or type 1A, there is a feature through the center, and in the title it says of the Lopez paper, a jet-driven supernova explosion. Mm. The only thing is, if you have a supernova remnant, you don't expect the jet to go through the center, right? Because it's a jet that came from the explosion. So whatever produced the jet should be out there somewhere. So whenever you see a feature going through the center, it can't be a jet from the explosion, unless you have a neutron star or something else that is still producing something there.
Hmm. We'll just let that hang.
Yeah, right? That's not really a question.
Sure, yes, please.
So just on the morphology of 3C397, there's a these things called classical novae, and they're very good progenitors for the single degenerate scenario. And their morphology in the shells are a ring, an equatorial ring, and polar cones. And this, to me, looks really like sort of one of these classical nova shells. I have a poster. It's a S10.7, and it talks about a recurrent nova super remnant. So you have 1.38 solar mass white dwarf, very close to the Chandrasekhar limit. And it's got a big barrel around it of swept up interstellar medium and nova shell matter in this sort of morphology. So it does make sense from the classical nova world anyway.
Okay. So this is great, Dan. We've started discussion about what the shape of this is. We have a now poster everyone has to go see. So I think this is good.
Very good. Any other questions? Okay.
10.7, his poster.
Very good. Well, let's thank Brian again for the talk.